We are delighted to introduce Professor Vicky Brown, a distinguished faculty member at Criswell College. With a profound commitment to both academic excellence and spiritual formation, Professor Brown brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to her role. She holds advanced degrees in theology and education, and her research interests span biblical studies, pastoral care, and the intersection of faith and culture. At Criswell College, Professor Brown is dedicated to equipping students with a strong theological foundation and practical skills for ministry. Her engaging teaching style, combined with her passion for mentoring, inspires students to deepen their faith and develop their calling. Outside the classroom, Professor Brown actively participates in community outreach and church ministry, embodying the values she instills in her students. We are privileged to have her as part of our academic community. This introduction was wrote by ChatGPT.
All right, so that was so amazing. I keep wondering who that person is, because it's not me, not even close. I'm on. Do you want me to? I can yell.
There you go.
Okay. So, gentlemen, my PowerPoint. See, you're having to rely on technology. Just the first screen, so I know it's up. There we go. All right. I did not plan this in light of our speaker in chapel yesterday. I'm just always amazed at how God weaves everything together. This is the first time I've ever been allowed, invited, to speak in chapel. Maybe the last time. We shall see. We shall see. In light of that, when I asked them, okay, so what can I do? I've never done this before. I've never spoken in chapel. They said, Dr. Brown, you can do whatever you want to do. The power. So, that being said, I have about 12-minute video that we're going to start with. It is a podcast that was recorded in Zoom. And so you'll see the two people talking to each other, and it's technically a podcast. It's a TED Talk. And the reason I wanted to start here is y'all get enough beating you over the head about those little boxes that you carry around in your hands. I carry one too. And so what they're going to do in this TED Talk is they're actually going to sort of explain you to you, because your generation has never known a time we didn't have those. It's like when I used to teach fifth grade and I was talking about inventions, and I said, when I first got married, there was no such thing as a microwave. And my students, my fifth graders, looked at me with horror and said, how did you pop popcorn? I said, on the stove or in a popcorn popper. They didn't know what I was talking about. And so it's kind of the same thing with y'all. You've never known a time those were not available in some form. And they're just a reality. But part of what we need to do is examine that reality in our lives and what the implications are for our Christian behavior and our Christian outreach and our obedience to the commands of God and what He expects of us as believers. And just as a little aside, a little caveat, the speaker is very secular, and so there is going to be just a little snippet in there where he talks about billions and billions of years ago, all mammals do this, and that's why humans do this. Okay, just kind of block that out for just a minute, because everything else he has to say is very eye-opening. He's going to walk you through your childhood up into your college years with those in mind. And so just listen and kind of do a little bit of self-examination. And then we're going to come back around, and I really do have scripture to support it. I really do. God has something to say about cell phones. Okay? So, Ralph, if you could start the video. Thank you.
Hello and welcome. I'm Elise Hugh, the host of the TED Talks Daily podcast, and I'm so glad to be with all of you today for our TED Talks Daily Summer Book Club, a special series on the TED Talks Daily podcast. It's a show where we deliver ideas that inspire every day. So today we are slowing down to ask, what are our phones doing to childhood and to us? Around 2010, we all observed the mental health of young people in the U.S. starting to get worse. Rates of depression, anxiety, suicide, and self-harm started climbing up and haven't come down. In his new book, The Anxious Generation, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt makes a strong case that the cause is smartphones. He looks to Gen Z as an example. They came of age with unfettered access to the internet and social media, and he argues that these numbers are the consequence of the new childhood reality. John Haidt, welcome, and thank you for digging into this with us.
Well, thank you, Elise.
So much of this book really hinges on the moment around 2010, when a few dramatic changes took place in the digital world. Talk to us about what happened then and why you consider it a big deal.
So let me actually start in 1990, because you have to understand how we all got tricked into this. So if we go back to 1990, there was no internet. Nobody knew what the internet was. So the internet arrives around 1994, 1995. And it's amazing. It's like God said, hey, do you want to know anything instantly? I still remember how exciting it was. So the internet was amazing. And the millennials were teenagers at the time. They were going through puberty. And they charged onto it, and they made it their own, and they found all kinds of ways to do things. And they started internet companies, and they're a creative, successful generation. Also, the Berlin Wall fell just before that, and democracy is ascendant in the 90s. And we're thinking, democracy, its best friend is the internet. How could a dictator ever keep it out? Good luck, China, keeping out the internet. So we were all super optimistic. Once you get the smartphone, 2007, now you start getting the App Store and apps, you get Uber. So all of this is miraculous, okay? So our kids love it. Kids always love technology. And we're all like, well, okay, they're spending a lot of time on it, but you know, maybe it's making them smarter. It's going to teach them tech skills. So this is all good, we thought. So that's the setup. And if you were born in 1990, let's say, then you hit puberty around 2002, 2003. You go through puberty with a flip phone. You use your flip phone to call your friends and to text them one-on-one. And you meet up and you do things in the real world. So you're fine. You go through, you have a normal human development, normal human puberty, and you come out the other end as a mentally healthy person.
Okay.
But suppose you're born in the year 2000. You are 7 when the iPhone comes out. You got a front-facing camera in 2010. You are 11 when you probably got one. You got on Instagram when you were 12. So when you hit puberty, you're going through puberty not meeting up with your friends. You're going through puberty swiping, tapping, liking, and hanging on. What if I post something? How will people react? Half of our kids say they're on the internet almost all the time. 50%. Almost all the time. This is not a normal human childhood. There's not as much face-to-face contact. You don't get to develop social skills. You don't have hobbies. You don't read books. You're just on your phone all day long. And guess what? Their mental health collapsed, especially for the girls. Instantly, it's not a slow thing. Instantly, around 2012, you get these hockey stick shapes in all the graphs in my book. There was no sign of a problem in 2010. And by 2015, it's all over the world. We don't know about the developing world, but all over the Western world, we start seeing this, especially for girls. So that's the story.
And what do you think was going wrong?
So the story I tell in the book is two things. I decided not just to write a book about what social media is doing, but to write a book which is really more about childhood. What is it? Why do we have it? Why is human childhood so different from every other animal, including chimpanzees? Because we grow up fast after you're born, but then you slow down. And we don't grow very fast until we hit puberty. Why? Why do we delay? We have these amazing cultural brains. This is our great adaptation. This is why we cover the world and chimpanzees don't. And that all depends on a slow growth process with a lot of cultural learning from your elders, from the people ahead of you in your culture. So that's part of it. Also part of it is play. Young mammals need a huge amount of play, free play, to wire up their brains. All animals practice skills they'll use as adults. So you take what was called, what I call the play-based childhood,
yeah,
which is what we've had for about 300 million years, going back to the beginning of mammals. And then 2010 to 2015, kids now have a phone-based childhood. And that, I argue, is what's blocking development. We've never seen such a sharp change in generations in terms of their mental health. So that's, you know, that's what we see when we look back historically. We can certainly now discuss it, you know, the research trying to pin it down. But what I'm pointing to is an incredible pattern of changes that happened in many countries simultaneously, always with more increases for the girls, not affecting the middle-aged people, but only affecting the teenagers. And no one can offer another explanation other than the transformation of childhood by the technology.
You call this transition from a play-based childhood to a phone-based childhood a great rewiring. So mm-hmm. How do you believe the minds of these Gen Z kids are wired differently now?
Let's think about it this way. For those of you who are over 35 or 40, you surely had a play-based childhood. What I'd like you to do is think back on the most exciting things that you ever did as a child. Think back on times you just were hanging out with your friends. Think back on how much time you spent laughing with your friends, laughing, joking, playing around, okay? Now take all of that, cut it by 80%, because Gen Z didn't get that. They have almost no unsupervised time. They don't get to hang out behind the 7-Eleven or down by the river or in a playground or anywhere except online. So take 70% of that out. Think of all the times you smiled at a person, where you made eye contact. Take 70% of that out. Now, again, I don't know the exact number, but for the kids who say they're online almost all the time, it's probably 70%. Think of all the books you read. Take 70% of those out, maybe 100%. Gen Z has no time to read books. They have so much content to consume to keep up. There's very little book reading. Think about hobbies. Did you have a hobby? Take that out. So you take out almost everything. Because again, if the latest numbers are on average, American kids are spending 7 to 9 hours a day on entertainment and screen stuff, not counting school. 7 to 9 hours a day is the average, depending on how you count it. Take childhood, take out almost everything that you valued in it. And what's left?
But does hanging out have to be in person and with making eye contact in real life? Because a lot of these kids would argue we hang out all the time. We hang out in games. We hang out, you know, on social platforms. We are connecting. We're just connecting in a different way.
That's right.
And John Haidt, you're the fuddy-duddy, you know, for coming down on just the different tools that we're using to hang out and connect.
Oh, that's a great objection. And, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, when I first saw Twitter and people sending out, oh, I just had a hamburger, I thought, God, this is so trivial. But then as a social psychologist, I thought, well, actually, wait a second. Like, if you're like sort of checking in with your friends hundreds of times a day, that could be really good. But what I've come to see is the online world gives you multiple ways to connect virtually, which often lack certain properties. So the most important one is being synchronous. So right now, you and I are synchronous. We can see each other's facial expressions. But on Zoom, there's a little bit of awkwardness. You know, you don't quite get the timing. So video games, Twitch, all these things that allow you to, well, that allow you to go two-way voice and face, those have some benefits. I'll grant that. Whereas going back and forth with in group texts is performance, not connecting one-on-one, like an old phone call. So synchronous is good. All the asynchronous ones, I think, miss that. Another feature is that you now have such vast quantity. Imagine taking the number of people you talk with every day, multiply that by 50. Okay, that might sound great, but how much time do you then have for anyone? Right. So you don't get the kind of in-depth conversations. When I was a kid, it was just sort of famous that girls will talk on the phone for hours and hours at night, one-on-one, just one-on-one. They're connecting. Boys don't do that, but we'd call each other up, say, hey, can you come out? And we'd meet and we'd go do something together, one-on-one or in a small group. That's all great. The large groups are not connecting. They're performing. And kids are anxious. They have to think carefully before they put something out, because what if I make a mistake? play needs to have lots of low cost mistakes. You say something stupid, your friend says, oh, that was mean. And you say, oh, sorry. But when you grow up online, it's like growing up in a minefield because you never know. One mistake, it could actually ruin your life. It could literally ruin your life and make you not get into college. So this is something that so many professors have observed. We can't get our students to disagree with each other anymore. They're so afraid. They've grown up in a minefield. They know one false move and their leg gets blown off. So I think this, you know, you can praise all those virtual connections all you want. They don't seem to have the magic ingredient of hanging out with a friend in real life.
And the way you explain it in the book, the rise in anxiety and depression isn't really happening in isolation because it also sort of coincides or interacts with a change in parenting culture. So talk to us a little bit about that cultural shift that you're saying is happening all at the same time.
A big part of this is the overprotective parenting. And, you know, so I can summarize the whole book by saying we've overprotected our children in the real world, we've underprotected them online. So let's look at the overprotection. Until the 1980s, American kids had a free-range childhood. I grew up in the 70s, and there was a huge crime wave. There were crazy people. There were serial killers. Crime was at historically high levels. All kids went out, and it was amazing and exciting. And, you know, we got into all kinds of, you know, arguments and fights and sports games, and just we had an exciting childhood. And that goes on until the 90s. Now you get the new media environment. So you get cable TV, you get 24-hour news cycles. Mm-hmm. So in the 90s, for a lot of reasons, we freak out and we lock our kids up. Or rather, I should say, we no longer think it's okay for an 8-year-old to be outside unsupervised by an adult. Now it's more like 10 or 11 is when kids get that level of freedom. So here's the big reason why. It's not just the change in television and cable TV. The biggest reason, I now believe, is the loss of trust in everyone else. There's a great phrase from a British sociologist, Frank Furedi. He talks about the collapse of adult solidarity. So even in the 70s, when there was a lot of crime, you know, if I wiped out on my bicycle and I got hurt, my friend could go knock on a door and say, hey, can you call my mother? But we begin to lose trust in each other. Life moves away from the streets and moves indoors as we get air conditioning and television. We don't know our neighbors anymore. That's why we don't trust our kids to be let out. So there's a whole backstory that really begins in the 80s and into the 90s, in which we took away the play-based childhood. Oh, and at the exact same time, the internet arrives. And so, you know, we don't want to let our kids out. But this new internet thing, the kids love it. They're sitting in the room on a computer. What could happen?
5 hours a day is the stat now.
For social media.
On average.
It's right. Seven to nine in there, if you include video games and porn and all the other things that the kids are doing. But just social media is 5 hours a day average.
Okay, there we are. All right, before we go on, as I do in my classes, I'd like some comment or reaction from y'all. We're going to talk to each other. Yes. Okay. So what do you think about what you just heard? It's okay to disagree with it or agree with it, whatever. Whatever you want. Yeah, yeah. Are you safe where you are? Yeah, that kind of thing. All right, another one. Daniel, I see you in very deep thought. What? What do you think?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting the difference between synchronous and asynchronous, sort of media and internet use in general. So. Okay.
All right, one more. Yeah, Michael.
I like how you mentioned that it's also like you were being used
Yeah, his book, I have not read his book, but I really think I want to. And it is the idea that from a very early age, your generation has been introduced to things that sometimes I wasn't introduced to till adulthood. Some concepts, some actions of others, you know, all sorts of things. And as a younger child, and trying to understand that is very difficult. Okay. Paula, you cannot answer. At what age is a girl's brain considered fully developed? Nope. At what age? Stephen, what do you think? We'll have a guy answer. At what age is a girl's brain fully developed according to scans? He wins the prize. 21. Okay, so 21, ladies, your brain is fully developed. At what age are the guys' brains fully developed? It's a trick question. Never. There we go. No, there actually are scans that show this. Nash, what do you think? 25. There you go. 25. All right, so just stop. Just stop. Most of you in here that are students, your brains are still developing. They're not finished. They're not finished. Some of you, your brains are finished as far as physical development. But most of you know your brain is still wiring and figuring things out. And what you've put into it has implications. There's this wonderful study that I usually hand it out in the Roots class. Y'all may actually get a copy of it. That they did an experiment with college students, and they had their smartphones, and they said, okay, we're going to move your smartphones to different locations, and we're going to give you something academic to do, and then we're going to test you over what the academic material was. And so first was the phone was on the desk with them, just turned over. Okay. The second group, their phone was in their backpack. And it could be in the same room. Okay. And then the last one was they had to move their smartphone, not with the backpack, to another room. All right, so what do you think? What do you think happened? Dioceline, what do you think happened? Well, what do you think happened on the academic test? On which one?
On the academic test.
But were they more focused on if it was on the desk, in the backpack, or in another room?
It wasn't the other room.
If it was in the other room, that proximity affected the grade. Where your phone is affects your grade. A lot of you bring them to class. Oh, I'm just going to fact check my professor. That's why I have it. As if we don't realize how much you're texting while we're talking. And so a lot of you have it in the room. And you put it face down on the desk, which on a certain level I appreciate. Some of you don't get them out of your backpack. I appreciate that even more. On the rare occasion, some of you don't even bring them to class. Those who don't bring them to class make better grades. Why? Paula, why? Why would your grades go up if the phone's not even with you?
Because they would have focused more on the professor, what they're saying, instead of focusing constantly on the phone.
Oh. Yeah, it has to do with your attention span. They've actually done research. Your attention spans are shrinking. Your attention span right now is not as good as mine was at your age. And I've told students that I've had before, I am not the sharpest knife in the drawer. I am not the smartest person in the room. Not nearly. You do see who's sitting up here on the front row. Yeah, it's Stephen. But no, I just work really hard and I take notes, I pay attention. I sit up close to the front in the classroom so I can watch the professor. My brain works kind of weird. If I don't see you, I don't hear you, kind of thing. And it's not because I have a hearing loss. It has to do with how my brain integrates what I'm hearing. So I always sat on the front when I was in college so I could track. I'm tracking the professor, I'm keeping notes. And on top of that, all the other students were behind me and less of a distraction to me. I try to do the same thing at church. Sit up front. Oh, what? Okay, I don't know what happened there.
But I like that was a point of emphasis.
That was a point of emphasis. I told y'all I was going to get around to the Bible part, and I have like 4 minutes. Our church uses the King James Version. I grew up on the King James Version. I love the language of the King James Version. So we're in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. My favorite parts of Scripture are the genealogies and the lists of people's names. People always look and go, really? You read the genealogies? I do. And I pay attention. I just think it's amazing. God chose to write those people's names in Scripture for all of history to learn from. If nothing else, their names are in there because they were either very faithful or very not faithful. So you get to the very last chapter of 1 Corinthians, and Paul is starting to go through this list of people he wants to thank. And there's very specific reasons why. So you get down to verse 13, and he's giving kind of a final, come on, Corinthians, you can do it. And he says, watch ye, stand fast in the faith, don't give up. I think that's called grit. Quit you like men, that means to be brave, because it's not going to be easy. Be strong, let all your things be done with charity, love. And I love the next verse. It's the only place in the King James Bible this word appears. I beseech you, brethren, you know the house of Stephanas, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, and that they have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints. Number one, I find it fascinating that back in the era of King James, they used the word addicted. It's not a modern word. We think of it as current today. Most other translations are going to use the word dedicated or devoted. But I like addicted. When you're addicted to something, those little phones back there, you are consumed. You can't wait for the next fix. You have to have it. You have to. It means life to have it. You're addicted to the ministry of the saints. What a way to be remembered. That they were addicted to taking care of others, to spreading the gospel, to taking care of people in the church, to listening, to speaking out. I don't know that I can say I'm addicted to the ministry. I do love it. I do love it. When my children were born, I really did believe they don't belong to me. I walked the aisle and gave them back to God when they were little babies. And then almost 30 years later, my firstborn left, took his wife and my grandchild, and went to Australia as a missionary for 5.5 years. And I had people in the church go, "How can you let them go?" And I said, "They said, aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid to let them go?" And I went, "I'm afraid not to let them go. If God's called them to that ministry, who am I to stand in the way of that?" Each person in here has a calling. God is trying to call you. But sometimes what surrounds you blocks out his voice. I titled this, "Is God Trying to Call You?" I do realize God never has to try to do anything. He does it. Or he chooses not to do it. But it is something for you to think about. You're here, you're preparing yourself for who knows what God's going to put you into in your life. When I was sitting where you were sitting as a freshman, sophomore, junior in college, this was not my plan. Not at all. Not at all. But God directs, God leads. Are you listening? Or does that little box actually do what his research shows, and it takes up between 5 and 10 hours of your day? I just don't have time to read my Bible. But you have time to check social media. I'm just so tired, I can't sleep. But you sleep with the phone in your bed. Later on in the video, he does talk about that. The lack of sleep. And a lot of it is being traced back to those being in beds. So just something for you to think about. I ask my classes all the time, why are you here? You could be anywhere. Why are you here? And so just start thinking through how we are using what has been provided in our culture. Are we using it for the furtherance of the gospel? Are we using it for our own entertainment? Are we using it so we don't have to face things? We can escape into it? What are we using it for? I went 7 minutes over. Do y'all want to talk?
I think we should end it here.
I would like Dr. Moore, though, to share a personal experience.
Panel, but I think Dr. Brown shared so much great information with us, so let's give her a hand. Thank you so much. That was great. But Dr. Brown did want me to share one story about a phone in a dishwasher, so I'll do that really quick. A couple of weeks ago, Alex couldn't find his phone anywhere in our house. Y'all know Alex. Some of y'all know Alex. He's 15. He's my youngest son. So Alex couldn't find his phone. He had had it 20 minutes earlier, and he couldn't find it. He started tearing it apart. I was actually already in bed because my new rule is I go to bed at 9:30. And so I was in bed. Thank you. So I was in bed. I'm not going to tell you that I was watching TikToks. That's neither here nor there. And so after about 15 minutes, they went through the, because he had been playing with the dogs on the couch. Another story. And so they had torn the couch apart. They thought his phone had gone in the couch. He came and got me. He said, "Mom, I need your expert eyes. We've got to find my phone." And I looked at him and like like he was breathing heavy, and I looked at his face, and he was upset. And so I got up and I said, okay, even though I have boundaries, right? I said, okay, I'm going to try to help you find it. We tore the house apart. We looked at Life 360. We knew his phone had been in the house. We were trying to look at what area of the house his phone was in. And I mean, as the minutes wore on, like you could tell, like his body was, he was getting very upset. He said, Mom, I need to punch something. Can I punch the glass on this? I said, no. I said, let's punch the couch cushions. But he was so upset he needed to punch something. Well, it finally got like 10:30 and I was like, okay, the boundary's got to go back up. Mama's got to go to bed. We can't find the phone. And so he went to bed without a phone, a sophomore in high school. And the next morning he was like, can I stay home from school? No, you can't stay home from school. When I told him he couldn't play in the football game, if he stayed home from school, he went to school. I opened the dishwasher and the phone was at the bottom of the dishwasher. So the phone had gone through the dishwashing cycle. We have no idea how it got there. His anxiety went up and up because it was 2 days before he could get a new phone because I made him order one instead of buying one at the store because it was more expensive. But anxiety, and so we had a long talk about addictions, and because he and I had had this discussion about being addicted to your phone. But yeah, Stella's going through the same thing now. I didn't tell you because her SIM card won't work on her phone.
Oh no.
And so, but I mean, I think we all feel that way, and so I think we all have to work on it. So we didn't get a time to have a panel, but I know Dr. Sanders has talked about it with his daughter. Dr. Keyser has a lot of great ideas about managing your time with your technology. It's a great tool, and we're all trying to think about how to deal with it. I do oftentimes put my phone in a different room when I'm working. And my friends and my kids get mad at me because they're like, I texted you 2 hours ago. And I'm like, well, I was working, so... I need to focus.
Boundaries.
Yeah. So, Dr. Brown, thank you so much. That was really helpful. And you're dismissed. Thank you, guys.